shortly here, and H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Well, here I am. I'm sorry about last week. I'm going to upload a substitute show to the archive, and I suppose that and the other one that I still need to upload from last October about my visits, sort of part two of my visits to the research reactor near Munich, will probably be part of what I throw in the pot for the Anon Radio 35-hour anniversary marathon this week. Let's see. What else is there to say? So, I do have... So let's see, the most recent film transfers that I got back that are now posted on Tubnix are, firstly, a French commerce promotion film produced under government auspices in the middle 60s to try and encourage people outside France to buy French-made nuclear power plants, these being the plants of the so-called UNGG, Uranium Naturel Gaz Graphite, in other words, equivalent to the British Magnox plants. And they did succeed in selling one export order at Vandellos in Spain. But those UNGG plants just were not hugely successful, either technically or economically. Really a very different story from the British Magnox plants, which performed far better than originally anticipated. Anyway, but it's a very interesting film, even if it is in the French language. It shows you things you wouldn't ordinarily see, the assembly of the graphite bricks and the fuel loading mechanism and that kind of thing. I, at least, found it really interesting. Of course, I can understand some of the narration. My hope is to find someone who understands French well enough to transcribe the narration and then get it translated and then caption the video. Unfortunately, that hasn't been done yet. And I'm sorry. But you may enjoy it anyway. Then the second one is a Russian, or rather Russian language, school film from the USSR. This is actually one of four such films that I procured from a dealer in Ivano-Frankivsk, Western Ukraine, at the beginning of this year. And so I'm gradually getting those transferred. Again, same comment applies. I need someone who speaks good Russian just to be able to transcribe the narration. And then translation is the second step, and then making up the captions, breaking it up into captions and timing them is the third step. But it's quite an interesting film. There's a model of a breeder reactor. There's illustration of how the moderating process works using what appear to be pool balls or something similar of different weights. So you can see the difference between an elastic and an inelastic collision, which is a pretty nifty demonstration. And there's stuff like, electric power high-tension pylons being transported, set up in the Russian Far East by helicopter. You see the shadow of the pylon in the helicopter over the endless forests. And, on the other hand, also the Shevchenko or Aktau plant in Kazakhstan, which used a breeder reactor, fast breeder reactor, and had an attached seawater desalting plant. Anyway, there's shots of, camels, things like that. So it's quite interesting. I've received, also, I think I may have mentioned, that I have been, as I can obtain them, buying these records that the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission put out. Audio records, LP records, which were, in most cases, intended for broadcast on radio stations as part of their public affairs programming. And if you were listening to Hear Now the Words this past Tuesday, I used some segments from one of those for filler material. I actually have, at this point, two records, each of which is a 3-LP set, and each side of each disc has 2 10-minute talks. Which is a total, I guess, of 4 hours. Is that right? Can't be. Let's see. 20 times 2 times 3. No, two hours, surely. Now I'm getting confused. No, I mean, each 3-disc set is 6 sides, each 20 minutes, 120 minutes, 2 hours. So yeah, two sets is 4 hours. I know that there are 4 sets. I've got Let's Talk About Energy and Let's Talk About the Atom Volume 2. The Discogs, the LP Collector's website, lists Let's Talk About the Atom Volume 1 and Let's Talk About the Atom Volume 2. It doesn't list Volume 3, but the package for Let's Talk About Energy refers to 3 previous volumes under the title Let's Talk About the Atom. So I know it's out there somewhere. Anyway, so that's some things that you can listen for in time to come. I have already, actually, in my Hear Now the Words slot, broadcast Century of the Atom, which is one that was not made for radio broadcast. It was actually given away to visitors to the U.S. Pavilion at the 1971 Geneva Atoms for Development Conference, which is pretty nifty. Hold on, let me... Anyway, so I've pasted that in the metadata so that you can, if you have a client that supports that, you can actually pick up that URL and listen to it. So yeah. What else is there to say today? I'm afraid I'm not the best prepared I've ever been, but there was a couple of things I wanted to mention. The first was a news item that came across my desk saying that essentially the current U.S. government, which came into office saying all kinds of things about how Saudi Arabia was a bad international actor, and you wouldn't believe what they did to that poor Mr. Khashoggi, and this and that and the other thing. Well, not only have they not stopped supporting the Saudi war in Yemen, they're now saying they're looking for a hard reset of relations with Saudi Arabia. Paper over everything, pretend everything is back to normal, pretend the Saudis are nice guys. Why, you may ask? The answer is very simple. It's all about the all. With sanctions being put in place against Russia, why, suddenly there's a shortage of fossil fuels on the world market. And so every tin pot dictator and so on who can possibly pump a barrel of oil, we have to treat him like he's the most precious little creature that God ever created. We've got to do whatever he says. We've got to be nice to him, stroke his ego, not do anything that might make him mad at us. Because there's really no alternative, you know. We've got to keep burning those fossil fuels. To which I have one basic answer. And it is this. That's all. Maybe, if in 2014, when Putin seized Crimea and a chunk of the Donbass, maybe if the world had put heavy sanctions on Gazprom and Rosneft then, maybe the Germans would have not shut down their nuclear power plants. Maybe other people would have said, gee, isn't it true that being dependent on imports of fossil fuels from questionable countries is a vulnerability in both economic and political terms that we really can't afford? You know, you look at Sweden in 1980. In Sweden in 1980, the anti-nuclear lobby had put a lot of pressure on the government. And so they had a referendum. And the only two choices in that referendum were A, abandon nuclear power immediately, or B, allow reactors then built or under construction to operate until the end of their useful lives, and then abandon nuclear power. Well, those are the only two choices. There was no, let's just keep using nuclear power, it's fine by me option. Well, the Swedish people, the only people, as I've discussed before, ever to have an open democratic debate about building a nuclear weapon, the Swedish people voted for the second option. Because right about that same time, there was something known as the Iranian oil crisis. You remember that, maybe? There was this political upheaval in Iran which affected the world markets. There was a poster that was in circulation at the time from the campaign against the nuclear shutdown, which it was a takeoff on that anti-nuclear button or badge or sticker design with the smiling sun face in red and nuclear power no thanks around it and the yellow background. Well, it had the Ayatollah Khomeini in red with a white beard and a black turban, and it said, oil power no thanks. People realized that maybe, just maybe, they didn't want to be chained to this particular chariot. In fact, I find it really very interesting, suggestive even, that just at the time of the 1973 oil shocks, just when many countries were saying, "Whoa, Nelly! maybe we'd better do something to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. Just at that very moment is when these very, very loud and very well-funded anti-nuclear groups came on the scene, denouncing nuclear energy as the greatest threat to human life and life itself on this planet. You know, demanding that it be abolished immediately. Don't you think that's a strange coincidence that the one tool that's proven most effective in reducing the need for fossil fuels, much more effective than conservation, much more effective than solar and wind power, that just at the moment when people were recognizing the urgent need for it, a political movement sprang up to oppose it? Political movement that didn't lack for money, didn't lack for support in the press, and so on. It's strange. That's all I'm saying. It's strange. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. Sir Fred Hoyle, the noted astrophysicist, in a book published in 1977, outright said that the organization Friends of the Earth was taking money from the Soviet Union for its anti-nuclear activities. And Friends of the Earth threatened to sue him, and rather than fight them in court, he withdrew the statement, and the book was reprinted without it. But you know, things that were declassified after the collapse of the Soviet Union proved that he was absolutely right. Or here's a really fun one, actually. Do you realize one of the major suppliers of nuclear fuel, one of the major investors, or among the major investors in nuclear fuel reprocessing plants in the late 70s, early 80s in the United States were the oil companies? Exxon, for example. I was reading a report of some work where they were using plutonium fuel supplied by Exxon, and I've seen a promotional video that Exxon put out. There's a copy on YouTube. It's extremely poor quality from VHS about the uranium mining and milling operations and fuel fabrication. Matter of fact, I have an Exxon ad from the late 70s from a TV program called Tut the Boy King, narrated by Orson Welles, which is sponsored by Exxon. And at the beginning, there's this long musical commercial for Exxon. Here at Exxon, people work and people plan for the future and to help their fellow man. Anyway, which, among other things, highlights their manufacture of nuclear fuel. They were trying to get out of the oil business. Now, I don't necessarily think it's a coincidence that this is exactly at the same time that Exxon's own geologists and geophysicists were the ones who were making perhaps the most noise about climate change. Exxon was trying to get out of the fossil fuel business because they didn't see a future in it. At the same time, I believe Gulf Oil was one of the major investors in the nuclear fuel reprocessing plant in Barnwell, South Carolina, which was affected by the nuclear reprocessing moratorium, initially opposed by the Ford administration under strong pressure from the Carter presidential campaign, eventually retracted by President Reagan, but by that time nobody wanted to try starting it up because they didn't know what the level of political risk was. All of this is very interesting, and it doesn't lead to any definite conclusions. But it's worth thinking about anyway. I mean, people complain about nuclear power plants being subsidized by governments. You know, somebody came up with this paper study claiming that not only nuclear power plants, but nuclear fuel operations, in other words, uranium mines, milling operations, and so on, were so heavily subsidized by governments that in many cases, the electricity that, you know, the actual price of the electricity that was produced was so high that it would have been cheaper to buy it in the open market. Which, firstly, raises the question of what the electricity price would have been on the open market if not for the nuclear power plants and nuclear fuel projects, but it doesn't get to a much more important question. What do they mean by subsidy? Because if you look at their methods, you discover quite rapidly, and this is very true of the anti-nuclear literature, that their definition of a subsidy Well, a very popular one is the Price-Anderson Act. The Price-Anderson Act governs the insurance of nuclear power plants. It requires nuclear power plants to buy insurance from insurance companies. It also requires nuclear power plants to pay a substantial sum of money to the federal government in exchange for the federal government insulating them from financial liability in case of the most severe possible accidents. Now, the federal government has never paid out a single cent under the Price-Anderson Act. In fact, it has collected a large sum of money. But if you ask the anti-nuclear people, they will tell you that this is equivalent to trillions of dollars of subsidies, and that ought to be factored into the cost of nuclear power. As I've said before, one of the reasons that I go on in support of nuclear energy is the absolute mendacity of the people who oppose it. You know, I hate to say that, but it's true. The people who oppose nuclear energy, by and large, either don't know what they're talking about or are lying. That's a flat statement. You can quote me. You would find very great difficulty obtaining any evidence to contradict it. There you go. You know, and I'm working on a little pamphlet for distribution to friends in Canada, encouraging Ontario to keep the Pickering power reactors in operation and to run hot water pipelines from Pickering, High Snowdusk, to downtown Toronto, Ontario, where there are some very large buildings and campuses, university, government, corporate campuses, which use a lot of heat. Because if you want to decarbonize, right, if you want to reduce emissions from building heating and cooling, the big buildings are the first place to go. Because replacing household gas heat or oil heat with electric heat pumps is going to require millions and millions of individual decisions, which are going to be spread out over many, many years. Whereas, and again, as I said with the case of railway electrification versus electric automobiles, whereas this is something that could be done very rapidly. When I say very rapidly, evidence suggests the pipeline could be run within 6 months if it were considered urgent. You know, there would have to be modifications made to the heating plants in the buildings, but still, within a year or two, you could essentially eliminate the use of gas and oil for heat in central Toronto, which would absorb probably, you know, that's a lot of fuel that's burned. And where does the energy for that come from? It comes off the bottom of the thermodynamic cycle at Pickering, which means that it's very, very cheap heat. You give up something like 1 kilowatt hour of electricity generation for every 8 kilowatt hours of heat that's delivered. In other words, each of the 500 megawatt units at Pickering, by cutting back its output to 400 megawatts, could deliver 800 megawatts of heat. And there are 6 operating units at Pickering currently. 4,800 megawatts of heat is nothing to sneeze at. And, of course, by the use of hot water tanks, insulated tanks for storage, you can hold that heat over for several hours so that you can generate maximum electricity during the electricity demand peak and then cut back electricity generation during periods of lesser electricity demand in order to produce more heat. This is only sensible after all. We're talking about making better use of energy that the ratepayer has to pay for, that otherwise is just discharged into the lake because there's very little demand for heat at 35 degrees centigrade. Anyway, somebody on SDF Mastodon saw this, saw me direct this to a couple of friends. He said, well, you know, I just don't believe that we can justify any use of nuclear energy until we have a responsible way of dealing with the waste. You know what they say, if you can't pay for the tip, you can't pay for the meal. Well, firstly, there is nothing irresponsible about the way that nuclear fuel wastes are currently being managed. It's not a permanent solution. That's true. But a permanent solution isn't urgently needed because the quantity of material that's built up is quite small, and it's largely harmless You know, you have to actually open up the concrete containers and touch the stuff before it becomes any important danger to you. You know, it's not escaping into the environment. There's no prospect of it escaping into the environment. By the time the metal jacketing breaks down enough for it to begin to be affected by environmental factors if there were no concrete shielding around it, the radioactivity of the uranium oxide will have decayed substantially, and uranium oxide itself is extremely weather-resistant. As you might have guessed, you can't use something as a fuel in a power plant if it's not resistant to things like heat and abrasion and water action and so on. You know, it has to be a tough, resistant material, or you couldn't keep it in the reactor. Jesus Christ! Anyway, the point being, not merely that there's nothing irresponsible about the way that the nuclear industry is handling nuclear fuel wastes, but also that, compared to the current globally accepted best practice of discharging fuel wastes directly into the atmosphere by the billions of tons, almost nothing that the nuclear energy industry could do with its million-fold smaller mass and billion-fold smaller volume of wastes, because they are, of course, solid as opposed to gas, could be considered irresponsible. You'd just about have to grind them up and add them to the food supply in order to be irresponsible compared with what we are currently doing with fossil fuel wastes. So it's pointless to try and compare the handling of nuclear fuel wastes with some ideal wind and solar situation or what have you. You have to compare it with what's actually happening now. I just thought I'd get that off my chest. And you know, the world doesn't lack for stupid opinions, and I spend too much time talking about them. But sometimes they inspire me to say something that's actually relevant and valuable. So, Elon Musk has come in as a target for a lot of criticism recently, and I don't say that he shouldn't. I don't have any portfolio on behalf of the man. I mean, for God's sake, he goes to fancy dress balls wearing a bow tie that buckles in the back like a 5-year-old. If you're supposedly the wealthiest man in the world, which he isn't, but we'll pass over that, right? If you're supposedly the wealthiest man in the world, either you just wear what you want to when you go to one of these things because they're not turning you away, or you say, well, I'm not going because I don't like the dress code, and they, whoever it is throwing the gala, suffers for it. I say he's not really the wealthiest man in the world because he looks that way because of idiots buying Tesla stock at overinflated valuations. Give it a few months, and I suspect that'll come down, particularly as sales of the Ford electric Mustang continue to be very strong. Now, the thing is, somebody decided to complain about SpaceX taking money from NASA for space things. And at that point, I just couldn't stand it. I had to point out that SpaceX is giving NASA a much better deal than NASA normally gets. In other words, under the conventional procurement system, NASA pays what's known as cost plus to a contractor to develop something. And if the program is canceled, as it usually is, before delivery of the final article, the contractor gets most of the money and never actually has to provide a finished product. On the other hand, SpaceX is only getting paid when they deliver a finished product. They are bound by contract to invest their own money into what they're doing. And furthermore, they're delivering the finished product at a much lower price than the conventional contractors who've already had their development costs amortized by Cost Plus. Isn't that amazing? So SpaceX, whatever else you may not like about it, is not ripping off the federal government in order to line Elon Musk's pockets. Well, I said, you know, you may not agree with federal spending priorities, but that's every American's right, isn't it? And then someone says, well, do we really need all these satellites? The snappy comeback to that is, if you've ever depended on GPS to reach your destination, then yes, you have no right to ask that question because you do clearly need all those satellites. A slightly less snippy answer, do you like it when people die of famine? Do you like it when people die in hurricanes? Earth observation satellites prevent probably millions of deaths and billions of dollars of property damage every year.